joined by your colleagues, and Justice Babbage will talk with you. With that said, I'll turn to the second case today, which is 98-2552, which is Vice versus Midwest Security Insurance Company. Our first attorney is James Moore, who represents the Midwest Security Insurance Company. Mr. Moore?
Students, friends, Mr. Conway, and justices. My name is Jim Moore. I'm from Hartford, Wisconsin. I represent Midwest Security, the defendant and appellant in this case. This is a rather, from a factual point of view, simple case. It is what I call almost a bolt out of the blue case, because poor Mr. Tice, who is in the courtroom today, was driving his semi-truck east on Interstate 94 in Milwaukee when suddenly and without warning, 20 feet in front of him, he was in the middle of the lane, middle of the highway, driving a semi. He looks up, and 20 feet in front of him, directly in front of him and headed right at him, is, well, not a bolt, but this piece of iron that Mr. Conway has at the council table, which he says is part of a leaf spring, and I'll accept that because he knows more about leaf springs than I do. But that's what happened, and there isn't any dispute that that's what happened. It flew through the windshield.
Is there a dispute that it comes from a motor vehicle?
I honestly don't know whether it comes from a motor vehicle or not.
Does that make a difference?
No.
So it could be any debris in the road?
Correct. This case the case is the same whether it's a rock in the road, a chunk of ice, whatever.
Even a bowling ball, even a bolt
out of the blue. I think the issues of the case don't depend on whether that's an integral part of a motor vehicle. We know almost certainly it was not off of the vehicle to his right. That we know. It did not come off. It wasn't a tire that he saw come off of a vehicle and dislodge from the vehicle itself and actually hit him. It was something that was kicked up in the road or something that fell off of something, and that's how he described it. He does not know where it came from. If you read the deposition testimony in the briefs, you'll see that the first time he saw it, it was 20 feet in front of him and about 20 feet in the air. The only nearest vehicles were in the lane to his right. And there were
why doesn't it make a difference that it came from a vehicle? I'm thinking, let's say that I'm driving down the road and I am suddenly aware that my entire buckler system has fallen off the road and into the lane of traffic. But I keep on going. And then eventually somebody hits this and causes great damage to them. Now, obviously, the driver of that car that got hurt doesn't know that I'm the one that did it, but it did come from a vehicle. In sharp distinction to when I'm driving down the highway and I see that something has fallen off another vehicle, like a bowling ball, or something's in traffic, or there's a piece of wood, and eventually some car catches it and flips it up and hits. It seems to me those are really two different scenarios, and it could make a difference that one came from a vehicle in terms of recovering under your motor vehicle policy.
Well, you'd have to, in order to recover under any policy, you'd have to demonstrate negligence on the part of the other driver. I mean, that's this court and the appeals court have told us over and over that uninsured motorist coverage is the substitute for the liability insurance the other driver would have had. And you'd have to demonstrate that the other driver was negligent. And yes, if you saw somebody with an obviously loose muffler and you knew he was uninsured and the obviously loose muffler was continuing for some period of time, yes, there'd be an inference that there was negligence on the part of that driver, the uninsured driver. And in that case, yes, it matters that it's a part of his car. But let's suppose the same scenario, an uninsured driver in front of you who's towing something behind him. And one of those things he's towing is a bowling ball, which is clearly not a part of the vehicle, and he hasn't strapped it down properly, and it bounces around in the trailer, and it's been bouncing around for several miles, and all of a sudden it bounces out. Now, clearly, that's not part of a vehicle, and yet the issues are just the same, so I don't think it matters whether it's part of a vehicle or not.
I'm not going to
give up
on that, because I look at 632.32.4b that says when a required uninsured motorist and medical payment coverage, and then it says an unidentified motor vehicle involved in a hit and run accident.
Right.
And the cases talk about an unidentified motor vehicle that where there was physical contact. It seems to me that it's a much greater leap if you're talking about a piece of board that was on the roadway and because of some gust that went by caused it to come up and hit you, as opposed to a part of a vehicle, if you're talking about prior case law and you're talking about statutory coverage.
We don't know how this got on the road. It may have fallen off of a junk truck. It may have fallen out when there was an accident on the road and without, you know, as a result of the accident was dislodged and the Milwaukee Police Department didn't clean it up. Somebody may have tossed it off of an overpass. It may, in fact, have broken off of a passing vehicle as well. There are a lot of scenarios. So to me, it really doesn't matter if it is part of a vehicle or not. The fact is it was on the roadway or near the roadway and it happened to come through a fellow's car. We do not know how it came through. And it does, you know, it is not, like I said before, it is not where you see a car in front of you and the tire dislodges and rolls back and comes through the window. This is just a piece of metal coming through the air and hitting the windshield.
If the tire dislodges from a car, comes back and hits you, is there coverage
No.
in the policy?
No, not under Wisconsin law.
And why not?
Because there's no physical contact between the vehicles.
And so, I mean, that issue then evolves to whether or not physical contact with a part of a vehicle is sufficient for coverage. Hmm?
Well, I don't think the case ought to turn on whether fortuitously the piece of debris in the road happens to come from a vehicle or happens to come from a trailer pulling a vehicle. I don't think that's a reasonable way to distinguish these cases. The law has said, and we have five cases before we get to this one. This is, I don't usually get to this court with five cases behind me, all in my favor, all of which have said there has to be physical contact between the vehicles.
You think you're on a roll.
I know. I wonder why I'm even here, but... But I have five cases behind me, and the three of them are cited in my brief, too. I believe may have been passed out this morning. I'm sure you've already seen them, but I was required to bring them in today. And those are two cases decided within the last 45 days from our Court of Appeals, District 1 and District 4, all of which say there has to be physical contact between the vehicles. And that language comes, with all due respect, from one of your opinions, and that's the Hain case, which Justice Babich wrote, which says that physical contact, and I can quote you the language, although he's probably more familiar with it than I am, says the plain meaning of the term physical contact is apparent and requires a hit or touching between the vehicles. We discussed the term hit and run, which is at issue in this case, and stated the very term hit and run contained in the policy itself supports the plain meaning that we attribute to the term physical contact. The terms are unambiguous, they're given their plain meaning, and they mean physical contact between the vehicles.
But isn't that in distinguishing between the hit and run and miss and run? That's what that discussion is all about. I mean, heretofore, if it's a miss and run, it's not sufficient. If there is no contact whatsoever with anything.
I direct your attention in answer to that question to two other cases, the Wegner case, and the other one, one of the two ones that recently have been decided, I think it's the Smith case. Yes, both of those cases involved some contact. Those were three-car accidents, chain reaction-type accidents. There was a physical contact in the Smith case between the first car and the second car, and then the second car and the plaintiff's car. There was actual physical striking of all three vehicles, yet the Court of Appeals said there is no recovery under UM coverage against the driver of the first car who initiated the contact because there was no physical contact between that vehicle and your vehicle. There was, quite clearly, a physical contact because the second vehicle hit the plaintiff's vehicle. And it was also true in the Wegner case. The first vehicle missed the second vehicle, but the second vehicle, there was at least some evidence that the second vehicle struck the plaintiff's vehicle. But there again, there was a striking by a vehicle, but no uninsured motorist recovery because there was no contact between the two vehicles.
I thought in the Wegner case that the cars swerved, missing one another, but then Wegner were forced off the highway and struck a railroad crossing.
If you read the decision, you'll see that there's a factual dispute of whether the second car hit the plaintiff's car. That's mentioned
but
in the decision.
Hain, and this to follow up on Justice Bradley's well-taken point, Hain really pushed the envelope pretty far.
I mean, the dissent, you know, really, really carved us up on that case.
There was this biting dissent.
And said that we were really out of the mainstream, which I think we might well have been, but it made a lot of sense to me then. I don't know if it makes a lot of sense to me now. But that really pushed it. And because that was a miss and run, there was never any hitting. Now, here we do have an actual physical contact. One of the things I suspect that we were concerned about in Haines is the potential for fraud. That, in fact, somebody falls asleep on the road, goes and hits the side, and says, in fact, I think I mentioned this in Haines, maybe I didn't, that a person, in order to recover, could simply claim that they were, that they fell asleep, that it was another vehicle, and not their fault that forced them off the road. So, but here we've got actual physical proof of physical contact.
Right. And I know Justice Abramson, in her dissent in the Haines case, went after the justification for this rule as being to avoid fraudulent claims. I don't think it was really mentioned much in the majority opinion, except perhaps in passing.
That's a good point that I thought maybe I should have adopted.
But in fact, if you look at all of these cases, a fraudulent claim is never presented. None of the cases say that there's something funny about this case. In fact, the first one of these, the Midzich case, says there isn't a scintilla of fraud anywhere in this. These are all legitimate claims. This is a legitimate. I mean, there's no doubt this happened. I'm not disputing that. But in none of those cases is fraud ever claimed. These are all legitimate claims. But the policy is, the statute says, and the policy says, that there must be a physical striking between the two vehicles. And unless we rewrite the statute, or unless we rewrite the policy, that's what governs this case, it seems to me.
That's true only if this case implicates the hit-and-run language in the statute and the policy, right?
Well, there's under the statute, he can only recover under two scenarios. He can recover if the other driver was uninsured, and we simply don't know because we don't know who the other driver is.
Right.
So he can recover under that. But the statute goes on to define an uninsured vehicle as a vehicle that is involved in a hit and run accident.
Right. But the language of the statute is not exclusive; it's inclusive, right?
Exclusive as to what? You mean we can include other things?
Well, right. It says in this paragraph, uninsured motor vehicle also includes...
Right. This is the statute that says what must be included in an insurance policy. You must have uninsured motorist vehicle to recover against for the negligence of an uninsured driver. Here we have no negligence and no uninsured
driver.
Right.
So...
But now the statute says you must also include coverage for a vehicle that's involved in a hit-and-run accident. Hit and run means physical contact.
No, I understand that that's what all the cases say, but there's also the comprehensive language about UM coverage in 4 sub A of 632.32. Is there not? And if we analyze the case under that language, it's your position that the plaintiff loses because he can't prove that he's entitled to recover.
Right.
Okay.
And I don't think even Mr. Conway's going to tell me he can identify the driver that may have caused this piece of debris to be in the roadway, nor can he identify whether he was insured or not insured. And so he can't recover under that. But the statute has been extended, and the statute was extended because the insurance policy had it in there before the statute. The insurance policy, we're including coverage for hit-and-run vehicle. And our policy defines a hit-and-run vehicle as a vehicle that hits you. A vehicle that hits you. Not a piece of debris on the roadway, but a vehicle that hits you. And yes, we could say, I suppose, as we just established, was talking in the last case about what's the right policy. Well, we could have a policy that says whenever you're driving down the road and you are injured through no fault of your own, that you recover. Kind of a no-fault situation. But that isn't the statute in Wisconsin, and it certainly isn't in the policy. I would like, you know...
The policy language may be narrow. If the court interprets that hit and run includes any debris, either on the road or from the vehicle.
You'd have to change your definition of hit and run from what was in the Haines case. Because the Haines case clearly says hit and run means physical contact, means contact between the vehicles. Well, the vehicle.
Then you'd have to... That's why your answer to Justice Bradley was that if a tire... Maybe it was the bandwidth. If the tire came off the vehicle and hit the next car, that would not be covered.
In my judgment, it wouldn't
be. In your judgment.
But it's a closer case, I will agree with you.
So what is the vehicle if it isn't the tire? Is it the door? Suppose the door flies off. Or opens. You know, it wasn't latched properly. It opens and smashes you.
That's it's a closer case, I will admit. Is the car a component of the car? Is it the rearview mirror? I don't think so. I don't think a vehicle is defined as the component piece of the
You're
car.
You're saying it has to be attached.
I'm saying, yes, the vehicle itself has to strike the other vehicle.
Well, then the door, is open door, is not part of the vehicle, is not the vehicle.
No, I think...
Oh, yes, if the door is still attached, I misunderstood. Okay. If the door is still attached...
So it flies off, it's no good. Okay, so it has to be an attached part. So if you hit the tire, one tire hits another tire on the road, that might not be good enough. If it's attached, it's good enough. If it's detached, it's not good enough.
That would be where I would draw the line. But this, you know, this piece of debris could have fortuitously been a rock in the road. Let's say it was a rock in the road. It's clearly not a vehicle. Would the rule be different if it were a rock as a piece of scrap iron laying in the road? I don't think so. This one happened to fortuitously come from a vehicle. I don't think the coverage should depend on the fact that somebody can prove this is a leaf spring. It may have fallen off of a junk truck. It may have been tossed there by a vandal. What I was saying earlier was...
Isn't that really a question to be decided later and not here? I mean, this is unquestionably a part of a vehicle. Why couldn't you hold, for instance, that if it's a part of a vehicle that flies off of the vehicle, that comes within the definition, and then if the lower courts decide what vehicle that's off of?
Because, quite frankly, all the evidence was in front of the lower court. We knew everything we were ever going to know about this case. We don't know what vehicle it came from. We do know that the first time it was seen was 20 feet in front of this guy, and it came through the windshield. There's nothing more to decide, my judgment, with all due respect. It's now, given the fact that this is an unidentified piece of debris coming through the windshield, is there recovery under a policy that says you can recover if the other vehicle hits yours?
Now here the trial judge, this is on page 13 of your brief, indicated that after reviewing the evidence and hearing the arguments of counsel, the trial judge agreed it could not be determined how and where the phantom piece of metal came from, nor how it became propelled through the plaintiff's window. So that's, I think Justice Babbage was referring to the finding before, which was appealed made by the trial judge.
Yes, that is in his decision. You'll see he devotes a sentence or two to the fact that nobody knows where this came from. I think everyone concedes that. The point I wanted to get back to before I forget it is this notion that what the plaintiff is asking for is almost a no-fault type of recovery. We don't know how this happened to be there. We don't know how it got propelled through the windshield. We certainly can't prove negligence on the part of anyone. But nevertheless, his client was without fault, and I agree with that. His client was without fault. And therefore, he ought to recover. Here's what this court said, Justice Heffernan, in the Amidzich case. He says, we have on numerous occasions expressed the opinion that it is a proper concern of the state that plaintiffs who have sustained injuries through no fault of their own be compensated by the tortfeasor. Courts, however, do not have the prerogative to engage in the equitable redrafting of contracts when the terms of those contracts are plain on their face. And that's, to me, the issue here. We have a policy which is the same policy that's involved, the same policy language that's involved in four of the five preceding cases. It's not involved in the original case. But it's a policy that says there must be a striking between the vehicles. We have four decisions that support that policy language, saying it's unambiguous, it's clear, and there must be a striking between the vehicles. To me, that is the beginning and the end of the case. If we're going to change that, then it is a legislative change. If the legislature decides that, notwithstanding the fact there isn't a striking between the vehicles, that we're going to allow anybody who is not at fault, who is injured on the roadway, to recover, that's a legislative change. And to me, the precedent is clear, and the policy language is clear. In fact, we have precedent that says it's unambiguous. The most recent decision that I'm aware of, and a copy of which you have received, is this Dehnel case, D-E-H-N-E-L. It was decided about a month ago by the Court of Appeals in, I think, District 4. Yes, District 4. Where we have almost the identical fact situation that we have here. If you just substitute a hunk of ice for the piece of sheet metal. We have a semi passing the plaintiff, a piece of ice believed to have come off of the top of the semi truck, flies through the plaintiff's windshield and injures the plaintiff. No recovery. No UM coverage. It is clearly a piece of debris. In this case, they apparently believe it came off of the top of the truck, off of a passing vehicle, and no recovery. And they make all the same arguments. I'm sorry?
The judge, Judge Rogensack, notes in it that a similar case is up before us, namely yours.
Correct. Oh, yes. No, I know. It was almost, I joked with Mr. Conway before, it was almost stay tuned.
Right.
See what's happening. No, I'm aware of that. And
Mr. Moore.
Yes.
If you were to win this case, you would know that you would not be covered under uninsured motorist coverage yourself if this happened to you. What would you do? Because we know you're an informed insurance buyer.
Well, I would buy good health insurance. But I can't get insurance coverage for an accident that happens where I can't prove somebody is at fault. That's the common law system.
The counsel, let's just go back to that. I think you switched gears on Justice Prosser. If not, you switched gears on me. Let's just take a scene where one car collides with another. Absolute physical contact. You're driving one, I'm driving car two. You are unidentified and are gone. And I'm left on the side of the road with a damaged car and a damaged personal body. So now I want uninsured motorist coverage, my own, to cover me. How do I prove negligence?
With your own testimony, you saw what the other car did.
Well, fine. Isn't that how you prove negligence in this case? But you're going to say here that they cannot be sure. But isn't there an inference in the certification memo? There's a footnote that talks about an inference.
And with all due respect, I disagree with that. I brought a motion, and that's the last thing I want to raise. I know my yellow light is on here. I'll raise before I leave here. And that is, I brought a motion for summary judgment in the trial court because there was absolutely no evidence of negligence on the part of anyone. And the trial court didn't even address that issue. And the Court of Appeals said, well, he's entitled to an inference. To me, there's nothing but speculation. To say that the driver in front saw that and decided to drive over it purposely and thereby threw it up, that is nothing but speculation. To say that the driver in front knew that he had it on the back of his truck and therefore it fell off, that's speculation. In fact, it is speculation to decide even where that piece of iron came from. The plaintiff simply doesn't know.
Well, one answer to your argument, of course, is that that's a matter for arbitration and not this court at the moment. Because that's a liability issue, and liability is an arbitrable issue.
My position is if there's nothing to try, we shouldn't be trying it. It's a waste of resources of everybody's part.
We is put, your position we put the, that if there's nothing to try, that you can't arbitrate?
Right.
I mean, the company drafted the arbitration clause.
Well, it's the same as summary judgment. If somebody is not entitled to a trial because the facts are undisputed and there's no liability, then we don't go through a trial. It's the same with, I put the issue in front of the trial court. I said, where is the evidence of any negligence? Mr. Conway or his client never filed anything in opposition to my summary judgment motion. And the trial judge never addressed the issue. It isn't in his decision anywhere. And the Court of Appeals saying, yes, he's entitled to an inference. Where do we get an inference from? We don't know how this accident happened. And to me, if there's nothing to try, and the issue was raised and it wasn't responded to, then we should be over. It should be summary judgment.
I want to test your definition of hit and run vehicle. Let's say I put a car top carrier on my car because I want to put a boat on or something, and I don't do it very well. And so I have a car top carrier driving along, and unfortunately, it falls on the vehicle behind me, comes off, and I take off. There's no coverage for the vehicle behind, for my car top carrier which in my hypothetical I negligently installed?
Because he cannot prove, he has to prove you are a hit-and-run vehicle. He has one of two choices. Either he has to prove you are uninsured, or he has to prove you are a hit-and-run vehicle.
Well, I'm going under your definition of hit-and-run vehicle,
and
I'm following up on the component part argument.
Right.
So I'm saying my car top carrier does not constitute, that hits them in the windshield, clearly coming from the vehicle right in front, is not a hit-and-run vehicle.
Right. Under the statute, under all of the decisions that we've talked about, and under the policy.
Well, I'm not so sure, because the cases primarily deal with not the hit-and-run, but the miss-and-run, the swerve, and so the discussion in a lot of those cases may not really be on point here.
There was a hit and run in Daniil. There was a striking in Daniil. There was a striking in Smith, and there was at least the suggestion of a striking, enough to get past summary judgment, in the Wagner case. All three of those had a striking involved, and yet there was still no UL coverage because the allegedly uninsured vehicle did not strike the plaintiff's vehicle. Hit and run is a device where someone is culpable, and
yeah, I think we're not emphasizing the hit. I think we're emphasizing definition of vehicle. Can vehicle include component parts?
Well, that's not what your case says. Your case says hit and run has its plain meaning. It is a driver whose vehicle strikes another driver and then flees the scene of the accident. We're, as a matter of public policy, going to allow an innocent person under those circumstances to recover. But in the circumstance where something hits the plaintiff's vehicle and he doesn't know where it came from,
my carrier has a strap on it, right? And so it falls off, but it's clinging by that strap. And boom, into the windshield of the next driver, and then I continue to take off. Is that a hit by my vehicle?
Well, that's an interesting question, and we're starting to get a little metaphysical because there's a strap now attaching the carrier to the vehicle. And I guess the way most appellate courts I read would say, that's a question of fact. Was it still enough attached to the vehicle that it was part of the vehicle itself, so that there was a striking between the two of them? But when it clearly becomes detached from the vehicle and is unassociated with the vehicle and is laying in the roadway, then it is not a vehicle. It is not. But it's an interesting question, and I suppose it would be a question of fact, or maybe you guys would decide it as a matter of law, that if something is still physically attached to the vehicle, it is enough of the vehicle that it would trigger this kind of coverage.
Thank you. Mr. Moore. You have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Mr. Conway, representing Mr. Fice, please.
Fice, Your Honor. Good morning.
Morning.
Honorable Justices, Mr. Moore, Mr. Mathias, Mr. Riley. Mr. Riley is also here from Midwest Security. It's my privilege to be here this morning to present my client's case and our argument as to why we believe he has a right to proceed to arbitration. I think one of the justices hit it on the head when it said that in Mr. Moore's arguments, he keeps switching gears. As soon as you start squeezing a little bit on the issue of is this covered or not, he backs away and says, well, they don't have a claim anyway because they can't prove it. And this is the problem that we faced when we were in front of Judge Langhoff. And Judge Langhoff, I think looking at the arbitration provision of the Midwest policy, said, hey, wait a minute, we're here to determine whether or not there is coverage. The way this began, Mr. Thies came to me. We reviewed everything. I looked at the case law. We looked at his insurance policy, and we said, well, I think this could probably be claimed under your uninsured motorist coverage. We present it to the insurance company, and they come back to us and say, this is not covered. So we look at the insurance policy again. The insurance policy says, if we and an insured do not agree whether that insured is legally entitled to recover damages or as to the amount of damages which are recoverable by that insured from the owner or operator of an uninsured motor vehicle, then the matter may be arbitrated. However, disputes concerning coverage under this policy may not be arbitrated, unquote. So that's where we start. They're saying, you're not covered. We have no recourse other than to go to court. And our legal action was not an action for damages against Midwest Security. Our action was for declaratory judgment, asking the court, the trial court, to declare whether or not, under the facts as they are now known, we have at least a prima facie case that we can take to arbitration. That's all we were asking for. And Midwest Security, apparently in an effort to hedge their bet, has decided to try to infuse the issue of liability into these proceedings. I haven't put on my liability case. If this court holds that there is coverage, I intend to put on a liability case. I'm going to bring in a motor vehicle inspector. I'm going to get someone possibly from the State Patrol to explain why they look underneath these semi-trucks on a regular basis to make sure that things like this are properly secured, that they're not cracked, and that they don't fall off.
So what you're asking us, let me put it another way to make sure I understand your position, that you're asking that us to essentially declare that this policy covers this type of accident.
Correct. And then we still have the burden of proving, as Mr. Moore said, we have the burden of proving negligence on somebody.
And doesn't that then entail the next question, which is, does the definition of vehicle include its component parts?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I don't think this court's review necessarily has to be limited to that, although I don't think we really have to go back and change any of the pre-existing case law. I think that what we're talking about here is a logical extension of the existing law. I think the Haynes case, and I was sort of hesitant to bring it up after reading it, realizing how the court must have struggled back then and reading the rather vigorous dissent, but the whole decision is scholarly. I mean, it was clear that the court put in a great deal of thought, a tremendous amount of research, and looked at the legislative history of the statute and what people in Wisconsin are supposed to get from their automobile insurance companies under their uninsured motorist coverage. And the point in the dissent that I think is of particular interest is that there's a legislative council note in the Haynes case, and it refers specifically to this language in the legislative council note, quote, a precise definition of hit and run is not necessary, for in the rare case where a question arises, the court can draw the line. And that's all we're asking the court to do, is to draw the line. And I'm not asking the court to make a zigzag. I think it's a straight, logical extension from where we are now.
Well, if the court draws the line, we've had numerous examples from my colleagues here and myself. You're saying that the line, I believe, would be drawn, that would be some part of a motor vehicle. Is that your line? Or as we threw out, we had lumber, we had bowling balls, we had other things on the road, and you've already had a finding by Judge Langhoff, I believe, that there's no way to determine whether this came from a trailer, off a junk truck, was off of the vehicle ahead, was kicked up, how long it had been there. That's going to be the difficulty that this court is going to wrestle with.
Well, I'm afraid that if the court follows that path, the court can avoid the whole issue and sort of take the easy way out. This is not the liability case, Your Honor. We're going to be presenting that if we get to arbitration. The court, I think, needs only to consider that this is an integral part of a motor vehicle. That would be enough.
Well, that's your limitation.
That's not necessarily my limitation. Okay. To answer your question, that's enough for my client in this case, but I think that the people of the state of Wisconsin expect more. I think the people of the state of Wisconsin reasonably expect coverage whenever they are injured under circumstances similar to this, whether it's a piece of a vehicle that flies off the highway and hits them, comes right off the truck ahead of them and hits them, whether it's a bowling ball bouncing out of a trailer that hits them, whether it's a car top carrier placed on a car without proper care that hits them. People expect that to be covered. And I try to run these things past people that I think are clear-headed and knowledgeable. I ask them for their opinions. I ask my 16-year-old daughter what she thought about this. She's never been to law school. She doesn't read insurance policies. but she has common sense. And I explained to her that if my client had been fortunate enough to be hit by the whole truck, he'd be covered. But because he only got hit by a piece of a truck, he's not. And her response to that was, "You have got to be kidding. Where is the logic in that?" It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. So to answer your question, we believe that the logical extension of the straight line that we're on right now, the contact rule, the rule that exists to prevent fraud, to prevent people falling asleep, going in the ditch, and then sending the bill to their insurance company, if we have highway debris that is projected through the windshield of a vehicle, if we have component parts of automobiles that are projected into automobiles and through windshields, if we have loads that come off of a truck, if we have car top carriers that come off of a car, if it's associated with the use of a vehicle, that should be enough to come within the ambit of the uninsured motorist coverage. I mean, the highways of our state are dangerous places. We read about these types of accidents all the time. Everyone knows about the family from Illinois where the children were burned alive because some semi-truck lost a mud flap. Somehow or other, the people in that case were able to track down the operator of the semi-trailer that lost the mud flap. And it's been in the papers. Everyone knows about it. And those people were compensated. But my client, I can't do no serial number on that thing. I can't tell you what truck it came off of, but it came off a truck. And whether it came off while the truck was going down the highway, I don't know. It got kicked up with enough velocity to go through the windshield of a tanker trailer truck. We know that much. We know how much force it took to get it up there. It does arise out of the use of a motor vehicle. And it arises out of the use of a motor vehicle that I cannot identify. The Tramp case was cited in our brief. That's the case where a man in a parking lot walking by a pickup truck sees a little dog sitting there. He must have reached over to say hi to the dog, and the dog bit him. And as it turned out, the owner of that pickup truck was uninsured and was identified. And in that case, the court said, well, this is what uninsured motorist coverage is all about. It's supposed to extend compensation to victims of people who are using uninsured vehicles.
But that case, counsel, was under 632.32(4).
That's not dispositive here,
right,
Your Honor. I admit that. But the point I'm trying to make is that the whole idea of having uninsured motorist coverage is to compensate the public for harm caused by people arising out of the use of uninsured vehicles.
Sure, but you still have to fit within the statutory definitions in order to qualify, right? And then
we have a hit-and-run
contract definition.
To qualify as a hit-and-run, there has to be the statute, again, this is interesting because the statute itself doesn't require, and again, I'm going back toward the Haynes case. I'm a little scared to go into that area again, but the statutory language does not require physical contact between the vehicles, period. The statute doesn't require it, but this court has read it that way and has consistently read it that way to deny recovery where the vehicles themselves have not collided. That's been the rule in this court, and the dissent in the Haynes case said it doesn't have to be that way because the legislature never really said it has to be that way.
Focusing on the statutory language, how would you define a hit-and-run accident? Because that's really what we have to do in this case.
I think a hit-and-run accident has to do with an accident involving a vehicle that's involved in the accident and leaves the scene. If there is physical contact arising out of the actions of the vehicle that leaves the scene. In other words, if the vehicle that left had something to do with causing contact with the vehicle occupied by the insured, that should be enough. I don't think it has to require a direct contact between the uninsured vehicle and the vehicle that the person is in. I think it's enough if the operation of the unidentified vehicle puts something in motion that causes physical contact with the vehicle that you're occupying.
Okay, so any sort of a hit will do as long as it's followed by a run.
As long as you can't identify the other vehicle. I mean, this is what this is all about. Not everybody that drives on Wisconsin's highways has insurance. And not everybody who's involved in an accident waits around to identify themselves. And it may be that, you know, as Justice Bradley is driving off to Monaco for her vacation, the car top carrier blows off and she doesn't see it happen. She may really not see it happen. She may not know what's missing until she gets to Minocqua. But if it goes through the windshield of the vehicle behind her and injures the occupants of that car, where is their recourse? Unless there's some way to identify where the object came from, they're out of luck.
Mr. Conway, when you're talking about the reasonable expectation of the insured, as you were previously and as you've just come back to, what about other provisions of an insurance policy, an automobile insurance policy, such as MedPay provisions or collision provisions? Don't those take care of a good part of what we're talking about here?
No, I don't think so. With all due respect, Your Honor, MedPay pays medical bills. Yeah, that's not even an issue in this case because Mr. Theis was working. But to answer your question directly, there is a panorama of losses above and beyond medical expenses and above and beyond the physical damage to the vehicle. Mr. Theis is disabled as a result of the accident. He's unable to provide for his family. Medical payments coverage doesn't mean anything. If Mr. Theis is incapacitated to the point where he can't enjoy the activities of his daily life, if he experiences pain on a daily basis, if he can't engage in the sort of recreational or social pursuits that he used to enjoy, MedPay doesn't mean a thing. The purpose is compensation. And I'm sure the court is well aware that in our system of law, compensation means whatever it takes to make the person whole. And your suit may or not made whole by getting your windshield fixed. Am I getting your medical bills paid? That's just the beginning. That's correct. That's correct, but again, Your Honor, it's not relevant to the case because the policy does not exclude people who are in the course of their employment, and I believe the law requires that he be compensated under his auto policy regardless of whether or not he was eligible for workers' comp. I don't think he can double up on the benefits that are provided, but he's still entitled to compensation for his pain and suffering, loss of enjoyment of life, and the other things that obviously are not covered under workman's compensation. So there are other things that protect people, but not everybody who gets injured in an accident involving a hit-and-run motorist is working.
One of the things that I'm just thinking, the example you give up in central Wisconsin, there's a great deal of logging, and then you could have a may get on the road from a tractor putting it there or just fall off something or lay there for a long time or be pushed on the road, and there isn't any vehicle involved except yours. So it's just debris on the road. And I appreciate the fact that this is a little different, but that situation would be, I assume you would want that to be covered.
Well, what I would want to be covered is an accident that arises out of the use of an unidentified motor vehicle that causes contact. And I'm not begging the question. You're talking about a log laying in the road.
I'm talking about debris that's laying in the road that isn't kicked up. In other words, it's there. As we've all seen, and I'm sure anyone that's driven for any period of time that has to drive around something has no idea how it got there.
Well, it becomes then a question of fact for the finder of fact whether that type of object should, in the exercise of reasonable care, been in the roadway. And if it's a log that fell off a lumber truck, my submission would be, if I were representing the motorist, I would say that it shouldn't have been there. The load is properly secured. It shouldn't fall off.
I didn't say, I don't know how it got there. I'm just saying that's one of the, you're talking about fraud here, one of the difficulties ascertaining these things when it's a one-car accident, one-truck accident without anyone else involved, just debris in the road.
Well, the possibility of fraud is a wonderful place to take refuge, I guess, if you're trying to avoid having to deal with a tough question sometimes. My experience
so
in trying...
it's a policy question and has been in these prior cases.
And my response to that is I believe that fact finders, whether they be arbitrators or jurors or judges sitting without a jury, are extremely capable of determining when something is or isn't fraudulent. My case with Mr. Theis may or may not fly. The people that listen to this in arbitration, if we get a chance to go there, may believe that we've been unable to meet our burden of proof. They may believe that, as Mr. Moore said, that this is an unexplainable accident. That may be true, but I think that that's something that should be sorted out in arbitration. And in looking at this entire matter, I think that the court has to look at the purpose of uninsured motorist coverage. The purpose is to provide compensation. The court has to look at the fact that this is statutorily mandated coverage. It's clear that the legislature recognizes the dangers of being out on our highways. It's clear that the court has struggled over the years with this whole concept of whether you actually have to physical hit between vehicles in order for there to be coverage. I believe in one of the recent cases that Mr. Moore just mentioned, Smith versus General Casualty, the case from District 1, that's the chain reaction accident case. And Justice Fine again raises the issue in his dissent, the same issue that was raised by Justice Abrahamson in her dissent. He's saying, well, why do we need this direct contact? Why does this keep coming up in these cases? The statute doesn't require it. In the case of Smith versus General Casualty, the District 1 case, the uninsured motorist who started the whole thing and left the scene hit vehicle number 2. Vehicle number 2 hits vehicle number 3, and vehicle number 3 sues vehicle number 2 and makes a claim against their own carrier for the conduct of vehicle number 1. Now, I would be here arguing just as forcefully, if that case were mine, that you have contact. You certainly have contact. And this is, again, not drawing a zigzag line, but following that straight line. There's no possibility of fraud. There's contact. There's physical evidence. We know that it was there. But as Justice Abrahamson pointed out before, the burden is always going to be to show that the uninsured motorist, the one that took off and left the scene, the one who's not going to be there to explain what they did or how they did it, the burden is always going to be to prove negligence on them. And it's not a given that you're going to be able to do it every time, and that's why we have an arbitration clause in the policy. Let us go to arbitration. Let me bring in my experts. Let me try to establish that this piece of iron should not have been on the Milwaukee County Freeway system. If the person that was responsible for putting it there had been acting in the exercise of reasonable care. That's all we're asking for. Yes?
Counsel, does the definition of hit and run in the Motor Vehicle Code have any relevance to this analysis at all?
Well, I know it was relied on by the Supreme Court in the case that we've been talking about previously, but I don't feel that as far as the criminal law and the civil law, I don't think they're necessarily the same. I think you're talking about apples and oranges. On the one hand, you're talking about punishing people that run into other people's cars and then leave the scene. If you look at the underlying purpose of having uninsured motorist coverage to compensate people who are victims of negligent conduct, I think the definition can be broader, and I think it needs to be broader in order to be fulfilling its purpose of providing compensation to innocent victims. I mean, we can't all, you know, drive Humvees or tanks down the highways. We can't protect ourselves from the actions of other motorists, people that don't take care of their cars, people that don't secure their loads properly, people that don't maintain their semi-trucks in this era of deregulation. We can't control any of that. I mean, we can try to miss things that are coming at us if we can, but Mr. Theis didn't have a chance. All we can do is try to buy insurance to protect us against those types of risks. And we're not asking the court to throw... We're not asking the court to walk away from all of the precedent that exists in this state. What we are saying, and I think the courts that we have cited in our brief from outside Wisconsin have agreed, that the contact rule can be satisfied, and it's certainly satisfied in the case of being struck by an integral part of a motor vehicle, which is what struck Mr. Theis. I think the rule would also be fairly expanded to include portions of a load of a vehicle, a rooftop carrier or something like that that was once purposefully made a part of a vehicle and came off and struck someone. Those are the types of things that should not happen in the absence of negligence.
How do you see the definition differ, if at all, the definition of motor vehicle in the policy as compared to the statute for uninsured motor vehicle?
Comparing the Midwest policy with the statute?
Let me be more specific. I note that the policy includes, Part C, C. Uninsured motor vehicle means a land motor vehicle or trailer of any type. So that's a definition of a motor vehicle.
and continues. And I note that the statute defines motor vehicle, as pointed out earlier by Justice Sykes, under 632.32.4a.2. In this paragraph, uninsured motor vehicle also includes. So I'm wondering if the definition of motor vehicle in the statute is more expansive than the definition of motor vehicle in the policy. And I note that in the policy, it's not limited to an intact automobile, obviously, but also includes a trailer, or can include the trailer. How do you compare and contrast the definitions of motor vehicle?
Well, I think the policy, the insurance policy, tried to paraphrase the statute and maybe didn't do it artfully. But the definition of uninsured motor vehicle that is contained in the insurance policy includes the so-called hit-and-run definition. And what they say in the insurance policy is, which is a, quote, hit-and-run vehicle whose owner or operator cannot be identified and which hits. They add that little extra zing in there, and which hits. The statute says involved in an accident.
Yeah, the statute says unidentified motor vehicle involved in a hit and run.
And it doesn't say and which hits. So I think that the insurance policy tries to track the case law, if you will. And it does not track the statute. Because the statute, as we've talked about at length here, does not require that there be actual physical contact between the vehicles. My point is this. I don't really care what this insurance policy says. Because my client's rights under the coverage that are is mandated by the statute. And what really controls here is what that statute requires him to have. And if this insurance policy gives him any less, it's invalid. I mean, my time is up.
No, your time isn't up. And that's just a Wednesday noon testing of the siren system. Your time will be up when there's a red light. I wish your time is up.
I believe I've answered Justice Bradley's question. Have I, Justice? Then I would just simply conclude, Your Honor, by indicating that it has been an honor to address the court. I realize this is a difficult issue, and it's one that the court has struggled with in the past. We believe that finding coverage here is consistent with the existing case law, and what we are asking for is a remand to the either to the circuit court for a trial or to proceed to arbitration. Midwest has never told us one way or the other, whether they would go to arbitration. And that's what the policy says. The parties can go to arbitration if they agree. If they don't agree, then we can go to court and have a lawsuit, jury trial, and the whole nine yards. But that's all we want. We want a remand to go back on the merits. Thank you.
Sir, I want to make sure I understand your position. Was it your position that if a bowling ball flew out of a car or a truck and hit a passing car, that would trigger a policy under your interpretation?
In my opinion, that type of accident arises out of the use, and you're assuming in your example, Justice, that the motor vehicle that loses the bowling ball keeps on going, doesn't stop. I believe that arises out of the use of an unidentified motor vehicle. And I believe as long as it's related to the use of the vehicle, it should be covered. I mean, an icicle falling off an overpass, no. But something that was loaded onto a vehicle, purposefully loaded onto a vehicle, that should be covered, in my opinion.
Ice on a vehicle?
Ice on a vehicle, that was recently addressed by the Court of Appeals in the Donnell versus State Farm case, and they said no, it wasn't. Although there are cases from outside Wisconsin that say, yes, it is. And this is why we come back to this whole concept of the contact rule. Is it time to revisit it in its entirety? For my client's sake, I don't think we need to go that far. But maybe it is time. Maybe it is time to look at this contact rule and say, let's follow the rule in the majority of jurisdictions in the state of Wisconsin. Let's throw out this court-made rule, assuming that it is court-made and not legislative. Let's throw out this contact rule. Let's give everybody a chance who's injured in these types of situations to go to arbitration or go to court and try to prove their claim. Maybe the contact rule no longer needs to exist. maybe the fact finders in our state are able to sort out fraudulent cases from the ones that are not. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Moore, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. As I listened to the argument and the questions, it occurred to me that we have two philosophical differences of opinion on what is involved here. Mr. Conway's statement of position is that any time his client or a plaintiff is injured and there is some connection to the use of a motor vehicle, he ought to recover. That is a no-fault kind of situation. That
ought to recover or ought to be able to go to arbitration?
Either one ought to be able to go to arbitration.
That's a pretty big difference.
Well, we're trying to establish the legal rule of whether he's even covered in the first place. And if he is covered, then I suppose he's entitled to go to arbitration, except if you buy my argument that he had no evidence of negligence.
Well, see, it seems to me this case presents a really subtle points here, and that your argument seems to sort of gloss over. But as I see it, the issue is not whether or not there is recovery. But the issue that we have to decide is whether or not there's coverage in the first place. Isn't that what we have to decide?
That's certainly the first issue you have to decide.
And that depends upon our definition of vehicle, does it not?
Well, it depends on your definition of hit and run.
Well,
it could depend on your definition.
What if the statute, 632.32 sub 4, when it talks about uninsured motor vehicle, what if there was an additional subsection that said, an uninsured motor vehicle includes any of the vehicle's components? Would we be here today?
An uninsured motor vehicle includes any of the vehicle's components.
Right.
That were involved in a hit-and-run accident or that...
Oh, yeah. You don't have to be hit by the whole vehicle, any part thereof.
Any part thereof.
Oh, well, sure. That's what it's...
by a vehicle, sure. Or any part thereof.
If it says, as long as you are hit by a part of a vehicle, mm-hmm. Yes, sure. I mean, he was hit by a part of a vehicle.
But it had nothing to do
with the negligence of the driver who fled the scene.
No, but of course not. But that has not been decided yet. What counsel, your opponent, is asking for is to be given an opportunity to determine whether or not there is liability. And so far, the issue of coverage has not yet been determined. And the issue of coverage depends upon the definition of vehicle.
In part, in my view, it depends on the definition of hit and run. But
Then let me get back to my initial question, counsel. If the statute said definition of motor vehicle includes any component part, or it was really clear, as the chief put it, that coverage if you're hit by a component part of a vehicle. Would we be here today, or would you be in arbitration?
We'd probably be in arbitration, except we might be in the appellate court if I move for summary judgment on the grounds that there's no evidence of negligence.
Sure.
But putting that to the side, yes, we'd be in arbitration.
You'd still have an ambiguity, wouldn't you? Whether it had to be a vehicle, a part of a vehicle that made the strike, or a different part of a vehicle. So if it was just as Babbage's muffler that he dropped on the road 2 hours ago, that this trailer then swings into your client, maybe it's still ambiguous the way that the way we have redrafted the statute.
Would Justice Bradley's car top carrier be part of the vehicle? It clearly wasn't original equipment with the vehicle. And why should we draw the line there? Why should fortuitously somebody recover if it's a part of a vehicle and not if it's a bowling ball? I mean, it's the same injury. It's the same heavy
because
object.
Because the statute requires it to be a vehicle. That's what we're talking about, a vehicle. I'm arguing a vehicle involved. I mean, talk about fortuitous. I think of, let's take my car top carrier. If it is installed by the manufacturer and comes off, is it covered as a vehicle under your definition?
No, it's not. If it's a component part, it is not a vehicle.
If I want to load my luggage and I've got a trailer at home, but I don't have enough of the trailer, so I'm going to put it on the car top carrier. I've got a lot. I'm going to put it in the trailer, and the trailer comes off. Is that part of the vehicle?
The trailer is defined in the policy as the vehicle, yes.
Is it defined in the
vehicle? They've always been part of
it. Is it defined in the statute as a vehicle?
I don't know, and I doubt it, but I don't know.
What about a part of a trailer?
That's right.
The trailer, if the car is carrying the trailer and the car are considered one unit for purposes of all automobile liability policies that I know of. But this policy is not unique, this is standard form. But if the part of the trailer comes off and is laying in the road, it is just the same as this thing laying in the road. It is not a trailer any longer. It is only the hubcap from the trailer or the ball from the trailer. I mean, we had, the whole purpose of the statute was, okay, we'll give you uninsured motorist coverage if somebody else is negligent and causes your injury, but they don't have insurance. We'll make one exception. If there's a hit-and-run driver and you can't find it, you're not a hit-and-run driver. We know the common-sense definition of a hit-and-run driver, and none of these examples are hit-and-run drivers. And now, all of a sudden, we're torturing this definition of hit-and-run driver to accomplish recovery anytime anyone is injured on the roadway, as long as they're not at fault.
Why am I not a hit-and-run driver? If I see that car top carrier come down and smash the windshield of the next car, and I say, you know, jiggers, I'm out of here.
You may be negligent, but you didn't drive your vehicle into someone else. That's what a hit-and-run driver does. You may be negligent for all kinds of things, but you're not a hit-and-run driver, with all due respect. I mean, this is what this court said. Getting back to this is what I wanted to say at the beginning of this thing. When Mr. Conway got up here, we have the notion here, the legislature has the notion of letting anybody recover when they're not at fault or making them prove fault and sticking to the definition. And here's what you said in the Hain case. Given this background, the legislature was confronted with two distinct policy choices. One, it could define uninsured motor vehicle to include an unidentified motor vehicle involved in an accident, regardless of whether physical contact occurred. Or two, it could define uninsured motor vehicle to include an unidentified motor vehicle involved in a hit and run accident. The legislature chose the second alternative. It is not the policy of this state to provide recovery whenever someone is injured on the roadway. It is the policy to provide recovery only in the case of a hit and run.
Could I ask?
Certainly.
A trailer is not normally viewed as a motor vehicle.
Correct.
Why did the insurance company write trailers into the policy?
All insurance companies include trailer in their definition of the policy. And I don't know the history of that, but it is historically always been included in the definition of motor vehicle. So that the two are considered a unit when they are operating on the roadway as a unit. And I wish I could tell you the history, I just don't. But it is in all, to my knowledge, it's in all policies.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. Thank you, Mr. Conway. We conclude our hearing on 98-2550.